Hey, before we get going, I want to give you a quick word from our sponsor, Audible. No one has more books read aloud than Audible.
And 180,000.
180,000.
Hell of a lot of books.
It's a lot of books. People who listen to the show are probably the kind of people who like books and like listening things aloud on their commute and what have you. So I suggest they go over to audiblepodcast.com/longform.
What's that URL?
audiblepodcast.com/longform. You'll get a 30-day free trial as a listener of the show. You'll also be supporting the show. Everyone will win. Here's the show. Thanks, Audible. Hello, and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. To my right, Max Linsky of Longform. To my left, Evan Ratliff of The Atavist.
Hello, Aaron.
Hey.
Who's on the show this week?
Leah Finnegan. People probably know her most from her tenure at Gawker. She left Gawker and is now at Genius, annotating the news. We talked about that. We talked about her departure from Gawker, which was amid this article that went up and got taken down, and interactions around ads and what's acceptable in terms of posting stuff. It's very interesting discussion.
Yeah, she's seen a lot.
She left after Gawker became Nice Gawker?
Yes, because she didn't want to become Nice Gawker. Literally, we talk about this.
Great.
She said that she was incapable of becoming 20% nicer. So I found her quite nice, though, and I hope listeners will as well.
Well, Aaron, if you wanted to find more nice people in the world, how would you do that?
I mean, I find that email is full of good vibes,
courtesy. Exclamation points.
It is. Like, I think that email is a nicer internet, and there's no monkey out there nicer than the MailChimp monkey.
So true. So true.
Over 8
lovable
million,
little chimp.
We've done over 180 MailChimp promos without even mentioning the MailChimp monkey. But it's deep in my dreams because, in addition to supporting this show for years and being a rock in our universe, they've also mailed me a bunch of these really comfortable T-shirts that my girlfriend sleeps in, and so I see that MailChimp monkey all the time.
You're basically in bed with MailChimp.
I have so many connections to MailChimp.
Oh, I got another plug we're at it.
Hey, yeah, talk about it.
We got a new Atavist magazine story out. It's at magazine.atavist.com. It's by Mitch Moxley. It's called Sunk. It's about a giant Chinese movie production for a movie called Empires of the Deep, which was supposed to be like Avatar, but made in China with international stars, except they weren't stars and the whole thing fell apart, and it's incredible.
Mitch Moxley, our office mate.
Mitch Moxley has been telling me about this story. He's an understated man,
yeah,
and he could not contain how crazy this story
is. If Mitch is plugging it, it's got to be very good, because I don't think he's ever plugged anything to me.
The 10, like top 10 most animated times I've seen Mitch Moxley have all been talking about this story.
Shouts to Mitch Moxley. Here am I with Leah Finnegan. Welcome, Leah Finnegan.
Thank you.
You've kind of had an unusual journey to end up as the news editor of the former rapgenius.com. You started at The Times. Is that your first journalism job?
I started at The Huffington Post.
Okay.
So I was in grad school at Columbia for journalism, and I got offered a job at The Huffington Post, so I dropped out of grad school. And a funny story is that they somehow mistakenly sent me my degree. So
oh, wow.
I have a degree from Columbia in journalism, but I didn't graduate.
Are you at all worried that someone from Columbia Journalism School could be listening to this and go back into your files?
Yes, sure. But, you know, my mom framed the degree.
Yeah, she's not going to give it back.
Right. It's in a suburb of Chicago that shall not be named.
Okay.
So, yeah. You know, they're not getting it back.
You can't take that away from your mom.
It's signed by Lee Bollinger.
So what was going on with you that you were ready to get out of Columbia Journalism School?
Well, the thing with journalism school is that, you know, you can either pay to do journalism or you can get paid to do it. So just, you know, I'm not an economist, but it just seemed like a better deal to get paid, you know, $13 an hour to do it at the Huffington Post, which,
right,
you know, at the time was like kind of a scrappy organization with like less than 100 employees in a loft in Soho. You know, they still like hand edited Alec Baldwin's blogs. And
I remember from that period, I don't know if this was true, but someone who was in your graduating class of the Huffington Post told me that if you left an italic open, it could turn the entire site into italics at that point.
Yes, that like the CMS, I remember, was like very intense, and it was like super, super brilliant. Like it was all like Jonah Peretti in his like early years, and or there were like several choices for headline size on the front page, and like one of the choices for a really big headline was "Holy shit!" Like that was just what it was called.
So you had come from a background. You were the editor of your college newspaper.
Yes, the Daily Texan at the University of Texas, and I kind of fell into that accidentally because I transferred to Texas and I had no friends and nothing to do, and I was very depressed. So I started.
This is how most people end up in journalism.
Right. So I started writing for the newspaper, and you know, getting $10 a week to write a column was like, you know, it was really fun. And then an associate editor on the paper had an internet gambling addiction, so he was fired. And then the editor at the time was like, do you want to be an associate editor because you have good grammar? And like, you know, this might be fun for you. So I was like, yeah, sure, you know, sounds fun. And then I was like, oh, like, I can get paid to do this really fun thing, like writing and editing, like this is amazing. You know, it's kind of like discovering capitalism. Whereas like I had been going to a liberal arts college where I was planning on like majoring in anthropology and becoming a professor, which, you know, I kind of shudder to think where I'd be now.
When you, as a, you know, former editor of this college newspaper, you're in journalism school, I imagine that the early Huffington Post didn't look exactly like what the journalism education complex told you that a publication you were going to work for looked like. I mean, what was that like, sort of like transitioning to a real like nascent technology blog empire?
It felt like it was the beginning of something huge.
Yeah.
It was amazing to be 23 there and have an unchecked amount of power. I mean, I was the editor of the college page, and so I would just make up top 10 lists.
Yeah.
That's what I did, because slideshows were great for traffic. This is when, like, page views were the metric that everyone was measured by. So we did, like, I would do, you know, slideshows, just pictures of colleges every day. Like, but I made up the top 10 hipster colleges. I made it up based on my own ranking of hipster colleges.
You probably changed like a bunch of kids' life,
right,
with
like,
that list.
I said Grinnell was the most hipster college in the nation, and I think their application rate went up by 30%.
Wow. What did you do when you left Huffington Post?
So while I was at the Huffington Post, I had a fellowship to go to Egypt to work at the AP, and like I had been putting this off because I had this job.
Yeah.
The Huffington Post, and the Arab Spring just like happened, and I was like, oh, like now would be a good time to go to Cairo, and like that was really like a turning point, because that was like real journalism, not aggregation, not like top 10 hipster colleges of Cairo.
Yeah, like, you're kind of like a maybe a mid-temperature pool between that like hot tub and ice cold water there.
Right.
So what was it like being dropped into the Arab Spring from the aggregation world?
Well, the AP newsroom was really, really interesting because it was an actual war room. Like, it was super stressed out, and like the journalists there are, you know, amazing and very professional and like bilingual and working 24/7 to cover the entire region. And like they absolutely did not want to deal with an intern, which was, you know, what I was. So I was just like, is there any way I can help?
Like, I feel like this is like the like setting for like a like wacky comedy. It's like
it kind of was
the
like,
intern at the Arab Spring.
Like the bureau chief was this grizzled correspondent who had been in Iraq like when Saddam died. Like he was the first reporter there, and I was like, you know, what should I do? And he was like, well, you can go to Tahrir Square, but you know, if it gets messy, just leave. And I was like, okay.
Was it hard to go back to ranking hipster colleges when you returned?
Well, after that, like, I returned and I was like, I need to move on.
Yeah.
So
I no longer can help Grinnell.
Right.
I'm always curious about how these different kinds of experience come off to employers.
Yeah.
Because there's something about the aggregation internet world and then the reported internet world that feels a little bit like when you give like a stand-up comic a sitcom. They're related. Like many people end up having both jobs, but they're strange bedfellows.
I mean, the New York Times was really, I mean, they're really interested in anyone who has internet experience. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, working at HuffPo was an advantage. And I think I interviewed at the Times for like 4 months. It was like, you know, trying to get into the CIA and, you know, for numerous different jobs.
Yeah.
And just like kind of like begging and being like, please, please.
And eventually you were successful.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to work here forever.
Yeah.
Until I'm dead.
How did that work out?
It didn't.
Yeah. Did you easily at least have like 1 year of feeling like you could work there forever, or was it pretty immediate that you knew you wouldn't work there forever?
It was like a slow realization, I think, because it's, you know, it's not a place that is super receptive to upward mobility of like very young people.
Right. Is that something that is a tension with younger people working there?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And like I was hired in like a class of like young assistants and, you know, we were all kind of told like, don't expect to like move up here.
Right.
Like you should leave and come back. And, you know, I was never really sure if it was like a mind game or if it was like the truth. Like a lot of it is like political jujitsu.
Right.
And some of it is just like discouragement. It's like S&M.
Where did you want to get at that point? Like, where was it that you wanted to get that you felt like you couldn't get at the New York Times?
That's a good question. I mean, probably the half of it was that I didn't know. Like,
yeah.
You want to, like, be able to write what you want, which is not really a possibility at the Times because, like, everything is so entrenched in a specific style.
Right.
And, like, you're not going to get to be editor because you can only be that when you're 60.
And what was it that you wanted to write at that point?
Just, like, anything.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they were experimenting with blogs.
Yeah.
And, you know, doing, like, more, like, free writing. And I did, like, some reported pieces, but I was always just kind of like, this is weird.
Well, it's interesting when you, I was on your Twitter before you came in here.
Oh, interesting.
I was looking at your Twitter.
Did you see all the pictures of Justin Bieber?
I saw a couple pictures of Justin Bieber, yeah. I was looking for actually links because I know that you have this initiative, and I want to talk about this in a bit, at Genius of sort of annotating web pages.
Right.
And I was like, where can I find some of these web pages? And the easiest way to find them was reading back through your Twitter
mm-hmm.
and seeing ones that you had annotated. But what I noticed was, like, I know your work primarily from Gawker, mm-hmm. from this time you spent at Gawker. Mm-hmm. And when I look at the sensibility of, like, your Twitter and I look at that period of Gawker, I'm like, okay, yeah, I can see how that same person did, like, made this stuff. Like,
mm-hmm.
I can see how you edited these pieces,
mm-hmm.
how you talked to these writers. When I see that Twitter and I imagine you working at the New York Times, I'm like, oh, that might seem like kind of discordant, you know? But there are people, you know, I think of people like Jenna Wortham who
right.
do kind of, like, bridge
yeah.
that gap, but
yeah.
it's new and it's unique that
yeah.
there are people with those kind of voices. For you, at what point did you realize, like, actually that thing I'm, like, doing on Twitter, that's kind of more like what I'm like than a person who's going to, like, wait 45 years to become editor at the New York Times?
I think probably when I got to Gawker, I was like, oh, I am a person.
Yeah.
I am not, like, a brand.
Yeah.
I cannot bow to a brand.
Hey, I'm going to pause things here briefly for a word from our sponsor, Squarespace. Max, Squarespace, they helped me put up those websites so fast.
Yes, there's been many occasions in which we've needed a website. It's been on your to-do list. It's stayed on your to-do list.
Okay. So Squarespace has a simple, intuitive process to put up a website. You can add and arrange your content and features with the click of a mouse. No code necessary. Plus, you get a free custom domain if you sign up for a year. That is excellent.
It's a good deal.
You get that free custom domain. You put a beautiful template on it. You are good to go.
All of a sudden, you look like a pro.
Our listeners, go to squarespace.com and enter code LONGFORM. You will get 10% off your first purchase, and you will be supporting this show. Squarespace, set your website apart. Here we are back with Leah Finnegan. Were you hired at Gawker as a features editor?
I was hired as a senior editor.
Okay. Yeah. I'm always curious. I kind of understand what a newspaper editor does. Mm-hmm. I understand less what an editor at Gawker does every day.
Sure,
and what the relationship between a URL produced on the Gawker domain and the person who is uncredited as that editor of that domain really is.
I mean, you know, if you ask like Nick Denton, he thinks like an editor at Gawker copies and pastes text into a box and presses publish.
Right.
Which was like one fundamental problem with the site.
Yeah.
But my main responsibility at the site was editing, and I was editing like 70-80% of the time and writing the other percentage of the time. And, you know, while I was at the Times, I worked on the opinion desk and I edited op-eds fairly frequently. And a lot of the times, like, we would have pitch meetings and I would have ideas that were like too weird for the Times or too just off the path.
Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of those ideas I got to do at Gawker.
Did you just keep a file of them? Like, I'll get them someday.
Yeah. I was like, I'm going to file that away and I will.
You guys.
It's going to be. Hipster
college rankings.
Like Grinnell.
I'm always sort of curious as to when something has that kind of volume, like where are all those ideas coming from? When you need to, what is Gawker post? 20 posts a day?
Like 40.
40 posts a day?
Yeah, now it's like 4.
Like how much friction is there between the idea and the post when you're trying to hit 40 a day? And that's basically in like an 8 or 10 hour like main window.
Yeah,
so you're talking
about
like one every 15 to 30 minutes, say?
Yeah, I mean, I would be working on like longer posts, like, you know, 1,000 to 3,000 words and doing like one to two of those a week. And those take like a few weeks of editing.
Yeah.
And, you know, from conception to completion, it's a long process to make that good. The biggest post I did there was a takedown of this blogger called The Food Babe. And I found another blogger called The Science Babe. And I was just like, rip this food babe apart. Like, she spews pseudoscience and like everything she says is wrong. And so the science babe just like took her down in this really glorious fashion. And that, like, I was like, maybe this will get like 80,000 hits. Like, it's pretty good. Like, I like reading it. I feel pretty good about it. It got 5 million hits. So that was like enormous for Gawker.
Are you thinking that with every post that you're, as an editor, like, behind, are you like, oh, this is like a 40-45 like thousander?
Yeah.
And are you thinking like, if I have like one weird one that's like a 10,000er, I need a big one to sort of like balance it out?
Yeah.
Does that warp your brain over the long run?
Yes. Maybe in a good way. I don't know.
Once you're like deep in the page views, like, are you kind of thinking like, I got to start like thinking of good high page view ideas?
There's no formula for like what's going to hit.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee.
And you're kind of riding the news cycle also, right? Because it's like, just because you had the story you described, it's not like you can be like, damn, I need another like scammy food blogger to like pop up so I can take her down.
Right. It's just like, what is a phenomenon? Like, you're only going to get 1 5 million person post a year. And like in the scheme of things, like that was one of the biggest posts on the internet last year.
Yeah.
And 5 million isn't even that much.
No. Well, yeah, I'm guessing if we went back and look at the scale of these, like, Huffington Post days,
right,
like, it would be like, yeah, we got, like, 10,000 hits on that story.
Right,
I mean,
right,
there's this kind of constant inflation of the page view.
Right.
I don't even think, like, I always actually sort of notice that you, even in the New York Times coverage now, you see, like, page views,
yeah,
and, like, YouTube plays cited as signs of popularity. And a lot of times I'm like, they're like, after that, he was a viral success. His video got 220,000 views. I was like, that's not really very many views.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, what, like, one of my duties when I worked at the Times was to tabulate page views for the opinion section, like using this really archaic program, and they didn't want me to email the page views, the page view like roundup to people because they didn't want it to be forwarded. Because they didn't want anyone knowing how many page views their pieces got.
So in Gawkerland, those numbers are public. Like,
right,
you can basically,
right,
tap into the back end of Gawker and look,
right,
at page views.
And the page views are on the page.
Right, they're on the page. There's a little fireball and it says how many page views it is.
The editors are ranked by...
I mean, I guess I'm just like, how does that feel? Like, how does it feel to be ranked with your other employees?
You know, it doesn't feel good, but
yeah,
like there is always like ambient tension over traffic.
Yeah.
It's like, how can we get more traffic? And now right now it's interesting because there's a conversation like everyone's stressed about traffic. Like,
yeah,
everyone's like, traffic is down, traffic is down, traffic is down everywhere. So I'm like, maybe like a sect of people died off and we just,
yeah,
don't know about it. Like,
or maybe we hit the like traffic
right,
ceiling. You,
like,
know what I mean? But I'm interested in, it seems to me that kind of an experience of working somewhere like Gawker is a more personal experience than working somewhere like the New York Times. You're putting a certain amount more of your own person,
right, yeah,
on the line,
sure, sure,
by,
yeah,
doing it.
Yeah.
Both in the like, I can see exactly what your job performance is like. It's,
right,
on the internet,
right,
as,
yeah,
relative to your coworkers.
Yeah.
But it also seems like when there is a blowback, you know, you can say pretty confidently, like, at least one story that Gawker posts every year, there's going to be, like, a,
right,
significant,
right,
blowback.
Right.
A lot of that falls directly on the writer.
Yes.
The writer is more vulnerable.
Right.
I mean, how does that change the equation when you're sort of being asked to get 20 or 40 things up as an editor,
yeah,
but if one of those things explodes, like, the explosion could be a traffic explosion or it could be a shitstorm explosion,
right,
or both,
right,
simultaneously.
Right. Yeah, like Gawker is so, it's so crazy because it's like, you know, your picture is there.
Yeah.
And like you're very, very like exposed and people are like, they just like automatically hate you for working there, which is like kind of cool. Like it's like a combative environment and like,
yeah,
all day you're just like throwing punches and it's like, you know, it's a very like us versus them mentality. Like,
yeah,
we called it like a pirate ship. Like,
yeah,
Gawker is the pirate ship and like you're very like everyone who works there is like very bonded together, which is, you know, not how it is really at any other place I've worked. There's not that sense of camaraderie.
Does that sense of us versus them and camaraderie extend to the bad times? Like, do people stick by each other when,
yeah,
the shitstorm starts?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Yeah.
And, like, when I took the job at Gawker, I was like, well, I know this will probably end badly. I will probably get fired, but,
yeah,
you know, this seems like fun. And,
yeah,
like, I'm, like, I really like Max Reed, so I'm going to do it.
What was it about it that you knew it would probably end badly?
Because every editor has gotten fired.
Right. Yeah.
And like with that, like his or her staff like gets the boot,
right,
as well. So, you know, I knew like going in as an ally of Max's that,
yeah,
if he left, I would be gone too.
Right.
And like he was like 4 months into his editorship when I started. So he had about like a year and a half left. And,
yeah,
yeah, sure enough, he left exactly a year later.
And I mean, what does that do to the social relationships among the people who are working there when the house is constantly getting cleaned out and, you know, one person's coming in as someone else is reaching their 1 year termination point?
I mean, there's a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah. I think this is kind of my secret belief that we're going to find out, like, this kind of like style internet publishing is like
terrible, terrible, like, emotional abuse and all
these
people.
Oh, yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Because, like, I mean, I say it as a joke, but I also, like, you know, for every, like, internet outrage storm, there is, like, a person out there. And I kind of wonder about the collateral damage, like, going both directions of just, like, people constantly being like, you're terrible, you know?
Yeah, totally, totally. I mean, like, Leah Finnegan mean is a Google search term. And it's just, like, from Gawker. And I'm just like, whoa, like, that, I mean, like, I'm from the Midwest. Like, I'm really nice in person.
Yeah.
But, like.
At what point did it turn dark for you? Like, when did the good times end?
like I said, there is always ambient tension because, like, when you're working with an unpredictable British millionaire, you don't really know, like, what his next move is going to be. And, like, that was, like, the good part of Gawker is, like, you only have this one owner, so you're not beholden to Putin's interests, which they might be now. I don't know. But you are also, you know, if whatever he wants, like, he gets. It's his company.
Right.
Like, you're kind of lucky to work there and that he pays you to do this ridiculous thing, which is, like, blog.
Yes.
Make little blogs about the media.
The piece that I know that sort of precipitated your exit from Gawker was this story about a married heterosexual executive for a media company having liaisons with a possibly mentally ill male escort who revealed his correspondence. Is that a decent summary of the article?
Right. He was paying this man allegedly for prostitution.
And there was some sort of vaguely extortionate-y kind of stuff in the emails of the man sort of demanding money for his silence.
Right.
Now, when I tried to sort of reconstruct, like, I kind of, like, looked around the internet and I was, like, trying to reconstruct, like, exactly how this whole thing went down. And I have my own views on it, and I won't try to be too opinionated because I'm actually curious about how something like that looks from the inside.
Yeah.
But from the outside, I was kind of like, that does kind of seem like something that Nick Dunn would publish. Like, it's the kind of thing that, like, I can imagine in the very first incarnation of Gawker, like, that's the kind of controversial material that, like, is like, wow, other people wouldn't do it, but I would do it.
Right.
And then it came out now, and people were kind of like, this is hideous.
Right.
And there was a kind of weird sort of like, wait, but I thought I was supposed to pick whatever pull quote for the back that I wanted kind of moment about it where he was sort of saying, like, this isn't what we do.
Right.
And anyone who'd been paying attention would be like, it's kind of similar to at least what you used to do.
Right.
I mean, how did, like, from within, how does that feel when you're kind of not sure what the line is and you're both being encouraged to test lines and also have personal repercussions for crossing them?
It was super confusing. Like, it was a total shit show and, like, no one knew what was going on and there were, like, secret meetings and, like, secret ballots and, like, everyone was like, I'm resigning, I'm resigning. I'm resigning. And I was like, what is going on? Part of the reason I went to Gawker was, like, that spirit of wanting to fuck shit up, like, being into gossip, wanting to talk about things that people didn't necessarily want to talk about. And, like, the stories that come to mind are, like, Bill Cosby and, like, the recurring, like, rumors about, like, Louis C.K. and, like, Fred Armisen, like, just, like, you know, men who do gross things and, like, there are rumors that maybe have truth to them, but, like, the Times would not report on them.
Yeah.
Because they can't, like, really nail it down, but
Gawker
will report on them. And, you know, I think that that spirit is really important, like, saying what no one else will say just so it's out there and, like.
But couldn't you say that Donald Trump is also saying what no one, I mean, like, okay, let's take that Louis C.K. example.
Yeah.
As I recall, the story was basically some guy said his friend was in a lock, was in a backstage with Louis C.K. and he whipped out his dick and asked her to do something with it, something to that effect.
Yeah.
And I remember reading that and being like, this is a pretty weird and thin story when I read it. Like, even for a, like, allegation, it was kind of unclear. It was like, and then I, like, told him to call me, but he didn't call me back, but he left me a message. It was like a guy telling you at a story at a bar about how he had confronted Louis C.K. was kind of how I took it.
Why are you driven to pursue a story like that?
Because especially in instances of sexual assault, people don't believe victims. Like, this is coming up with, again, right now with Woody Allen.
Right.
Like, everyone's like, Woody Allen's amazing. Oh, he didn't do anything. Oh,
right.
Did he? I don't know. And it's like, how many times do we have to, like, ask this question? Like, his daughter wrote an essay in the New York Times saying that he did this.
Yes.
He's a creep.
So I totally agree with you, except one of those stories
is
a guy in a bar told me. Another one is dozens of people, including my own daughter, and they're on, like, the record. I can tell you who these people are. That's the primary difference is, like, to me, where do you draw the line on the other kind of story?
With the Louis C.K. thing, it's like we're trying to, like, encourage people to speak out. And this is what publishing that does. And that's what happened with Bill Cosby. Tom Skoka wrote a post that was basically like, Bill Cosby is a creep.
Yes.
And then, like, Hannibal Buress spoke out about it. And then, like, more victims started coming forward.
Right.
Like, New York Magazine wrote their story. And then, like, now Bill Cosby's over.
I understand the narrative of the Bill Cosby incident.
Right.
And I understand the narrative of the Woody Allen incident.
It's like, how many stories do you have to hear about a person?
I guess as a reader, I'm kind of like, some of these things don't match the other things.
Right.
And the case that we're talking about of this Condé Nast executive, it seems like was divisive about within the staff about what camp that fell into.
Right.
What were your own feelings about it?
The story obviously needed to be reported out more.
Yeah.
The gay angle, I think, came off really badly. You know, I thought it was interesting that, like, an executive at Condé Nast, where there are, like, always cutbacks and layoffs, is, like, spending thousands of dollars on prostitutes. Like, that would have been a better angle.
Right.
But we didn't do that angle.
Right.
That's my own media criticism of that story.
What was the sort of feeling once that story was then pulled off of the internet, I think in about 24 hours?
Yes, that story was taken down.
And how did you feel about that?
I thought that was terrible.
Yeah.
Like, nothing should be taken down. Like, this is not, like, Russia.
Yeah.
Don't take a story down.
I guess I'm sort of curious as to what you think about what should be done if something does get published, but either it was wrong to publish it, like, because especially in that 20 or 40 posts a day, I mean, like, when that happened, I guess I was like, oh yeah, like, shocking, like, the trigger got pulled, you know, like, the trigger finger has to be pretty loose to keep up that kind of a publishing schedule.
Sure.
And so the looser the trigger finger, the higher chance of something, not that's just an error, like, we pissed people off, but, like, actually even our internal standards have in some ways been sort of violated by something like that. How do you think that could be, like, handled better? Because I think a lot of people who are publishing rapidly on the internet right now, like, it's not the only time when it's going to be like, ooh, maybe we didn't do that exactly right.
Right. I think places publish, like, way more than they need to.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, like, they feel like they need to do so much volume. It's like an expression of some stress.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of wonder, like, at a meeting, if you ever said, like, how about instead of posting 40 things, what if we published the 20 best? What exactly is the pushback on saving the worst 50% of the publishing cycle?
And, like, most people aren't, like, sitting at their computers, like, refreshing Twitter.
Yeah.
It's mainly just for, like, media people for them to have, like, grist to talk about.
Right. And I guess that's, like, I'm sorry, I keep coming back to this sort of, like, Louis C.K. thing, but I'm interested because, like, when I read something like that, I'm just giving you my, like, honest feeling.
Sure.
Like, it's like, that's grist to me.
Yeah.
To me, when you're, like, a guy at a bar, like, I have this one guy who says this thing, it's a little bit like the Donald Trump bait and switch where it's kind of, like, insinuating that you have something else, but not telling you what that other thing is.
But think about, like, if you're on the other side.
I'm trying to.
Like, I'm not trying to make this a gender play,
but that's sort of what I'm interested in. Is like, okay, so, like, obviously I'm bringing up, like, that from, like, a gendered perspective, and I brought up a gendered story. The the story of the Condé Nast executive is also sort of a story about like gender
and
sexuality. So it seems like there's some sort of a like fault line along gender and sexuality and stuff like that. Like not if I look at all of the controversy stories that have caused a controversy, gender and sexuality are like at the heart of almost all of them.
Yeah, it's hard.
So
it's hard.
So I actually hadn't really like I'm sort of unpacking this in real time. Why are those stories where the stuff breaks down, and how do you sort of construct the ethical framework around those lines?
That's a huge question.
Absolutely. We'll have you back on part two.
Women figure into everything I do.
Right.
And like everything I do is like from the perspective of like justice for women.
Yeah.
Like that's what I think about like 24/7. So
how much do you need to know to feel like you're like comfortable publishing in a situation like that?
I mean, you need to know a lot. Like you need to know a lot. And like for that story, we knew a lot.
Yeah.
It was all off the record, like deeply, deeply off the record.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had many, many tips, like tips from very high profile people who were like, this is true.
Do those tips come in that, like from that Gawker box, or are they like?
Sometimes, and sometimes they come straight to reporters.
Yeah. How do you sort through a bunch of tips and whispers and sort of separate the wheat from the chaff?
I mean, the tip inbox was like, you know, a super amazing, amazing place. Like,
yes.
Like almost every great story came in through the tips inbox.
What kind of a person tips off Gawker?
like a crazy person who's also like semi-media savvy.
Right. That's what I was thinking. You have to find Gawker. Like you have to sort of know Gawker exists to be a Gawker tipster.
And you also know that like if you're going to go to Gawker, like you're going to get a lot of exposure.
Yeah.
But you also might get screwed over, as like editors of Gawker have done to sources before.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't it almost equally likely that the person who is the tipster will become the subject of the story than the tip itself?
Yeah, definitely.
Because the first question is, where are you getting all of this stuff?
Yeah.
A tip that becomes a story, what does it like sound like as a tip?
Like one tip we got was like, I'm pretty sure this person is plagiarizing, and like here are some examples.
Mm.
And then we looked at all this person's articles and we're like, yep, he's plagiarizing. And we're like, great tip, great tip.
And in the case of like that married media executive
that
story,
came in as a tip.
Those were there were emails, so it wasn't even like there was already evidence attached to it.
He sent the escort sent in like screenshots of their texts.
Right.
And we were like, well, all right, we'll look into this.
When that tip is coming in from a like escort who is also sort of like extorting, like it's almost like he's kind of extorting him both ways. Like you're extorting through the media and through email. Like how do you deal with someone like that where you're like, well, this is an interesting story, but this guy is not in the right.
Yeah. I mean, obviously like that wasn't dealt with.
Yeah.
In a fair manner.
And that was sort of the spark that ended your tenure at Gawker.
Yes. I mean, after that, Nick, you know, decided Gawker needed to be 20% nicer. And I took a buyout because I was not 20% nicer.
Yeah.
So, yes, that was the end of my tenure at Gawker.
Did you consider becoming nicer? I don't even just mean in the context of Gawker, just like in general. Have you like were you already locked into the not going to fit into the nice regime identity?
Yeah, like I've been getting like harassed on the internet since I was 21. Like,
yeah.
So it's like nothing new.
Yeah.
For me to be like given shit, and I like really don't. It doesn't really bother me. So.
Is there like a cumulative weight to all that shit over the years? Like, does it wash off for you, or do you have to carry it around in a sack?
It's like an armor.
Yeah.
So.
It dries.
Yeah, it dries. It's impermeable.
Genius was your next job after Gawker?
I was actually at Cosmopolitan for 4 months, which
I did not know that.
Yeah, it was a super fun, like, field trip.
What were you doing at Cosmopolitan?
I was the executive editor of the website.
You're now at Genius.
Yes.
for people who listen to the show who are not, I think most people are familiar at least with sort of the origins of Rap Genius sure. as mm-hmm. a like lyrics annotation mm-hmm. site. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit about sort of how Genius is now branching out to be and needing to employ someone
sure,
like you.
Sure, sure. Well, about a year ago, some of the very smart engineers at Genius created a tool called the Web Annotator, which mm-hmm. lets you annotate any web page on the yeah. internet.
And some of the stuff was kind of already happening with people like copying and pasting in like political speeches and that kind of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. There was sort of a backdoor way to do
onto it. Onto genius.com. They didn't really know like what they wanted to do with the tool. And then like they reached out to me like last fall and, you know, they were like, we're thinking about what we want to do with this web annotator. Like we want, you know, they had like this platform called News Genius and, you know, they were trying to come up with a vision for it. And at first I was like, this is, you know, interesting, like annotating news stories. Like, what can we do with this? And like, yeah. you know, at Gawker, I had done like a lot of media criticism, which I love
right.
doing.
Yeah.
And it's like a totally rarefied field.
Sort of invented by Gawker almost, or at least the like way it kind of works now. I
right.
guess.
I mean, like no one reads it except media people, but yeah. that's like a very special audience. So, Genius and I just began talking about like what we would do with News Genius and the annotator. And I was like, well, what if I annotate news articles and like use it as a tool for media criticism?
Which makes a lot of sense because I feel like a lot of the trouble actually that places like Gawker and other places have run into over time is kind of like articles that are copy and pasted out of other articles
right.
into this article
right.
so that they can be commented upon. And there's
right.
a certain elegance to retaining the original web page while you annotate it.
Right. And like writing a blog post, it gets old and like writing is so, I hate writing.
Really?
You know, you can like engage with text on Twitter. You can do it like on Facebook, but it's not like, it's just cool how you can go like inside the page.
Yeah.
With the annotator. So I was like, this could actually, this is cool. This could work. So
what is the difference in sort of working directly on the text rather than sort of republishing? Like, what have you found with that as an experience as a way to criticize media?
It makes the experience like a lot easier. And
uh-huh.
it's more kind of stream of consciousness
yeah.
in a way. It's kind of humbling in that I'm like, well, I have like the entire internet before me and like, I don't know anything about like so much.
Yeah.
But I'm going to like work on what I really know and then like ask smart people to do the other things.
I wonder how you like avoid the pitfall of like, I feel like a lot of media criticism, like you kind of only hear about the media when it's fucking up.
Right.
Do people want to read a bunch of like the worst articles annotated for their failures?
Yes, I think they do.
Yeah.
I mean, because like the media is really it's really bad and like no one like does like there are media critics, but there's no like who is watching like journalists every day and
yeah.
like what like there are so many like shitty articles in like the Post and the Times and that are just like totally unchecked.
Yeah.
And they're just like really sexist or
it's almost like there needs to be like a public editor for the entire internet instead of the New York Times.
Right, right. No, for sure. And like Margaret Sullivan can't do it all.
Right. I actually really like Margaret Sullivan because I actually like reading about someone like internally looking into something they did within a company and are like, eh, we kind of fucked up here
yeah,
or like
for
that.
Sure.
But for most institutions kind of don't have the like courage to do that
right.
internally. So I think there is that role. But like, who's the audience for that stuff? Is it just journalists or is there actually like a layperson audience for that kind of criticism?
I think there's definitely a layperson audience. And I think like especially with like younger people
mm-hmm.
who aren't like reading the big dailies necessarily, like they, you know, automatically question authority.
Yeah.
And so they like are looking for holes in things. And,
yeah,
you know, there are so many like questionable news sites now and it's like are these good, like is BuzzFeed's news legitimate, like is it trustworthy? Like
I think I always people are horrible. Like, given the like free reign to comment on the internet, all I've seen is atrocities.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I mean, and I've seen it like at the lowest level, and I've seen it at the highest level. So now you're kind of engaging in being like the master commenter in a way, as being your job.
Right.
Are you able to find other people who are not like horrible to comment alongside you?
Yeah, I mean, that's what has been like super reassuring, is that the people who like come to use the annotator are like, number one, they're literate.
Yeah.
They write in full sentences, and like they know what they're talking about, and like they're very nice and thoughtful.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I read pretty much every annotation that comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'm like, wow, like these are pretty good. Like, these are real people. They're not like Obama killed my baby 44.
Do you think it's better at the stage you're at now with Genius because it's kind of smaller and it's like a sort of early adopter pool of commenters?
It's not that small. Like, 8,000 people have the Chrome extension.
What is the stuff that actually does merit annotation and comment? Like, what works?
I mean, it's actually really interesting, because like when I annotate something, like other people will flock to it. So it's kind of like leading by example.
Yeah.
So that's like kind of what my role has been like for the last 2 months. It's like I'm just going to annotate like consistently, like every day.
Yeah.
And then like the community of annotators who are very active on the site, like, will follow suit and, like, engage in the discussion. And, like, other staffers at Genius and also, like, other journalists I brought to the site will, like, join the conversation.
Right.
Every day I wake up and I read the papers and I'm like,
And are you looking...
What are we going to annotate today?
Yeah, like, what are you looking for when you're reading
like
the paper?
Like, anything that pisses me off.
Okay. So, like, that's an interesting, like, prompt. Like, what pisses you off evolving over time, or is it a static quality?
It's I mean, I wish it was evolving, but it's still like, it's kind of sad that it's remaining the same. It's like it's always Woody Allen. It just keeps coming back to Woody Allen. I've actually found myself really like into writing about sports. Like, sports sections are actually the most fertile ground for me for annotation, because they write about like women so like terribly. They're like, he had a great pitching arm, and he also used it to beat his girlfriend. And it's like, what the hell are you doing? This is really bad.
Does that mean you're, like, sitting on, like, all sorts of, like, regional newspapers, like, reading their sports section, looking for sexism?
I mean, it's, like, in the Times, in the Washington Post. Like, it's like, huge papers that are doing this. It's like, do you have editors? Have you met a woman?
Caring about that topic for a period of years, do you see any evolution?
My hope is that they'll read these annotations.
Yes.
Sometimes I tweet them at them, or I follow them on Twitter to intimidate them.
Genius is like a startup.
It is a startup, yes.
With like a beautiful like office and like venture capital funding and all of this stuff. And it's like you're like in this like big glass and steel machine, like calling out sports writers for their like latent sexism. Like, how are you regarded internally? Like, when someone from Genius who's like, me, I'm just like the biggest rap annotator, and you're like, oh, I've just been calling out sexism in sports sections all more. Like, what do they think of you?
We're all good. Like, we're all, you know, they're teaching me about rap. Like, I'm learning about Drake.
Yeah.
Like, who is Drake? I don't know. Like, I'm learning.
You didn't know who Drake was until you got the job?
Like, I vaguely knew, but, you know, I'm, you know, what is music? I don't know. I have, like, one album
really
on my phone. It's Justin Bieber. And, like, I'm teaching them about, you know, how the media is bad. It's a really good, like, give-and-take relationship.
If you were working at Gawker and I was like, rap genius or genius, you'd be like, all right, we're going to make fun of these dudes. Like, I don't even have to, like, we're sitting at a computer here. I haven't actually looked for this, but I'm pretty sure there is a Gawker article from your tenure ripping on the guys who run Genius.
There is no love for Genius, but, you know, at Gawker, there's no love for anyone outside of Gawker. There's only love for those inside Gawker.
But I guess I'm curious, does that, like, when you first meet those guys who are running Genius, are they like, oh, you from Gawker. Oh, let me like pull out this file of like you and
No. Like
the skin is thick enough.
No, like I respect them so much because they're like, we love Gawker and like we really love like your writing and like
yeah,
we want you to do that here. And I'm just like, oh my God, like I am like thankful for this opportunity. Like I like, how many more chances am I going to have? Like, I'm happy to do this for yeah, as long as you want me to. I hope forever.
Yeah. And your role now is kind of the Uber comment. You're like the Uber annotator.
You know, I'm the annotator in residence, and I'm also forming like partnerships with other media organizations mm-hmm, and bringing like other people in to annotate. So getting people to use the tool, increasing awareness of the tool. We have like a blog where we feature annotations every day.
Yeah.
It's multifaceted.
All right. So assuming that you don't actually do that for the rest of your life, like where do you see going? I mean, you've been on a pretty crazy roller coaster to get here.
Yeah.
What else do you want to do?
That's a really good question. I try not to ever plan ahead or think about the future because you just never know when, you know, you're not going to have a job.
Yeah.
So
that's the way that you deal with the sort of instability in the industry.
Right, right. Yeah. It's like, am I going to have a new job every year?
Yeah.
Maybe. Like, maybe my next job will be on an oil rig.
You heard that here first. Well, I think you're going to succeed at whatever it is. So,
thank you. It's very nice.
If someone wanted to go and check out these annotations, where can they go?
News.genius.com.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thank you very much to Leah Finnegan. Thanks to our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman, our intern, Courtney Harrell, my co-hosts, Max Linsky, Evan Ratliff, our wonderful sponsors, MailChimp, Audible, Squarespace, and wait, I have one more to tell you about, and that's Trunk Club. They make it easy to look your best in clothes that fit you perfectly, handpicked by your own personal stylist, for free with Trunk Club. That's right. Your own stylist picks out clothes. They send them to you. You keep them if you like to. Otherwise, no obligation. It's not a subscription service. There's no monthly fee. The stylist is free. Shipping's free. Everything is pretty much ready to go for you. So get started today at trunkclub.com/longform. You will be supporting this show and upgrading your wardrobe. Thanks, Trunk Club. We'll see you next week.